Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Local 28 against the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case raises the long history of the desegregation of Local 28 of the sheet metal workers of New York. This process of desegregation began in 1964, and I hope to demonstrate to you that it was essentially completed by 1975, in the sense that at that time, all barriers to entrance into the union had been removed, and no acts of discrimination against any minority person have been proved since that time. Now, since 1975, however, this union's been under the strictest kind of court order involving the strongest measures of affirmative action. Those have included a 29% quota, which I want to talk about at some length, because this is clearly a quota case. This is not a goal case. Further race-conscious remedies and total loss of self-government. Now, when the quota was not achieved by the deadline, which was fixed by the district court, then civil contempt remedies were imposed upon this union. And as a result of those, as a result of the fact that this was deemed to be civil contempt and not criminal contempt, the union was not able or permitted to defend itself by proving that it had not acted willfully and that it didn't have any control over the situation. As a result of this, a strengthened program of further quotas was imposed, more race-conscious remedies, 100%, a fund to be used 100% for minorities, and which cannot in any way be used to benefit white people at all. Now, I hope to demonstrate to you that the reverse discrimination in this case is beyond all boundaries. It's beyond the boundaries of Title VII. It's beyond what Congress intended and set forth in speech after speech during the debates.
Mr. Gold, before you get into the substance of your argument, would you tell me which paragraph of the decree imposes the quota?
It's the decree which sets forth
several paragraphs in your reply brief. Is it in those paragraphs?
In our reply brief and in our main brief, we set forth the specific, and we quoted the specific paragraph. I don't have the page number before me. We've got 1,000 pages printed here. But it's specifically, the original quota specifically states in the court's decree that by July 1, 1981, the quota shall be achieved. Excuse me, I do have it. It's A305. That's page 305 to the appendix to the cert petition, I believe.
Thank you.
Now, there's one point that I really think must be put on the table in this case. Many people who look at this case seem to apply a presumption to it, a presumption that since this union's been in litigation for all these years over matters pertaining to civil rights, The presumption is that they must be bad people. And some of the language which has been used, particularly in the amicus briefs, goes beyond all facts. One of the words which appears over and over again is egregious. And I want to demonstrate to you that when you scratch below the surface here, what's happened is quite the reverse. This union has really been forced, by virtue of this quota, by virtue of these other orders, to engage in more reverse discrimination than has been permitted in any case that I know about. And to say that this union is a bunch of bigots who will go to any extent and any limit to avoid taking in minorities just avoids the facts and ignores them completely. This union's done just the opposite. As a result of what's been imposed upon it, this union has taken in as many minorities as possible, and continues to do so. They have gone so far, and would go so far, if permitted, as to literally put up a sign at the entrance to the office where people could sign up for the apprentice program, saying blacks only need apply. And that's because of the court order which has been imposed against them. Now, it's important to bear in mind that sheet metal workers are a very skilled trade. As a skilled trade, it takes a significant amount of time for them to be trained. The apprentice program is 4 years, and not everyone can qualify for the apprentice program. The aptitude test that's been given for a good period of time now, under the supervision of the court's offices, is at approximately the level of 10th grade math, 10th grade English. And that's just to get into the program. Now, it would just be impossible, and no one's claiming otherwise, to simply open the doors and permit anyone to come in and become a sheet metal worker. It's as if you wanted to do the same thing with a profession. Suppose we have the legal profession or the medical profession. And suppose a determination were made that there was an insufficient percentage of minorities in those professions. And the federal judge said, as a result of that, we're going to integrate. And these professions are going to start to accept a larger percentage of minorities, and we'll give you an out date. And by that date, a percentage has to be achieved. On a somewhat lesser scale, that's what's happened in this case.
Well, are you challenging any finding that there was deliberate discrimination?
No, Your Honor.
There was deliberate discrimination.
Your Honor, I began
a remedy was called for.
Yes, sir.
And now, what was wrong with the remedy?
With the remedy was that it went beyond what Title VII
in
permits.
In what respect?
In that, to begin with, it contained a quota. Next.
When you say quota, you mean the 29.23%.
Well, it was originally 29%.
Well, but anyway, you call it a quota, and you say that the court called it a quota.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so that's one. What else?
That's one. The next is the total loss of control over self-government by virtue of the administrator. And the others are a variety of minor provisions in the order and judgment and the affirmative action program, about seven paragraphs of them, which direct that preferences be given to minorities in various aspects of hiring.
Well, do you make any claim that similar to the claim the United States makes, that the remedy was excessive because it gave remedies to people other than victims?
Yes, sir.
Is that part of your argument?
That's part of our argument, Your Honor. But we go beyond that because if we look at the case, if you telescope it to look for a moment at what's going on now as a result of these enhanced and magnified orders which have followed the contempt, Here we have a situation now where the last acts of discrimination that anyone's proved or even alleged occurred prior to 1975. And nevertheless, as a result of these orders, this union is presently maintaining two lists of young people who are applying for entrance to the apprentice program, whites and non-whites. And when a person comes in the door, we have to put them on one list or another. And 45%.
If they've passed the test.
No more test.
Oh,
now there's a selection board.
Okay.
And 45% of each class of apprentices is now minorities. Now, who are we?
Regardless of how they're graded by the
That's right.
selection board.
That's right. Now, who are we discriminating between? These are not the victims of discrimination.
Who do they choose first on the white list, and who do they choose first on the black list? Is it it's by grade?
There are no tests any longer. So well, there's
know,
a selection board, and what the selection board does is it goes over the qualifications of all of these people, and if they're going to take 100 people, they're going to take 55 whites and 45 non-whites.
Yeah, but there's the 55 whites who they believe are the best qualified.
Are the best qualified.
And similarly with the blacks.
Yes.
But they don't compare the two lists.
They don't compare the two lists.
Yes.
If they compared the two lists, it would not come out 55 and 45.
This is to get into the apprentice program.
That's right, which everybody acknowledges is today by far the major avenue into this union. Now, but the result of what's happened here is that who are these people who want to be admitted now? By no means are these the victims of past discrimination. You can't look at this case to expand that meaning in any way and come to that position. These are young people
who are coming into the workforce.
They're about 18 years old.
Who is on this board? Are they union people?
No. One is a person. We have several boards, and I have to keep them straight. I believe one is selected by the plaintiffs, that is by the state, the city, and the EEOC, one by the union, and one by the administrator, who's the judge's representative, the special master. Now, so we're discriminating between these young people who at the time of the last acts of discrimination that have been proved were approximately 7 years old at most.
Or they weren't born at all.
Or maybe some of them weren't born at all. That's correct, Your Honor. And this is going on, and we continue to be forced by virtue of this quota, which we've now been threatened, our very existence has been threatened, if we fail to meet this by August of 1987.
Well, why hasn't it been met up to date?
Well,
because 45%, allocating 45% to the blacklist doesn't augment the membership fast enough to get to the top?
By no means could it possibly do it. This was doomed to failure from the first. And it doesn't make any mathematical sense to have thought that it could have worked from beginning.
But
from
you're not free to put any more than 45% blacks on the list?
At the moment, we're not, Your Honor. Now, we've tried to get permission to put more than 45% on the list. Right after the original decree was entered in 1975, the problems here became absolutely apparent. This is 1975. And so the...
Resume there at 1 o'clock, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Gould, you may resume your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Before the luncheon recess, Justice White asked me why it was that during this period from 1975 until the contempt proceeding was filed in April of 1982, or I could even ask further until to this very date, why has this membership quota of 29% not been achieved? And that's an important question, and I'd like to answer it. Before I do that, I would like to tell you what the present figures are. These are not in the record that's before you, but they are filed with the court in New York, the Southern District of New York, and I think that the court can take notice of them. The present figures, the total membership, is approximately 3,100 members, and the overall membership, which is non-white, as that term is defined in this case, is 15.5%. Now, how is the term not?
Before you leave that point, Mr. Gold, is one of the paragraph to which you called my attention, which sets forth the quota, says by 1981 it had to be met, and of course, obviously, that date has passed. But am I correct that none of the contempt, specific findings of contempt against you are based on the failure to achieve the quota? Is that right?
Well, that's correct, that the specifications of contempt, which the district judge found against us and the Court of Appeals affirmed, did not contain that. The notice of motion to hold us in contempt, and the supporting affidavits by the attorneys for both the state and the city concentrated upon the failure to achieve the quota. That was the primary basis of their motion. The court, the district court, instead said he is not finding us in contempt for failing to achieve the quota, underlined not, and said, but he is convinced that the other failures, the specifications of contempt taken together, made it impossible for other reasons we didn't achieve the quota.
Whatever he found you in contempt for, you nevertheless were under an order to achieve a quota.
That's
your submission. And I'm still interested in knowing
why we didn't.
Right. Yeah.
And then,
figure was 15% now?
As of January 31 of this year. Now,
again, before you leave it, just so I have it clear on my mind, is there another paragraph that requires that the quota be met by a different deadline other than 1981?
Now there is, Your Honor.
And where is that in?
That's in a more recent order, which emerges as.
And then my second question is: have you specifically challenged that provision of that order?
Absolutely. That's one of the orders, which is on direct appeal to the circuit from which we filed this cert petition. Is the order which slightly altered the percentage to 29.32%, required that that percentage be achieved by August of 1987, and specifically threatened the union that its very existence would be in jeopardy by extraordinary fines, if they failed to achieve it by that date. And that's one of the primary orders which we're contesting here.
Mr. Gold, one of the things raised in your brief has to do with the order setting up a special fund.
Yes, Your Honor.
For use in connection with the apprenticeship program.
Yes.
Did you challenge the validity of the fund order under Title VII in the Court of Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor.
And we'd find that challenge in the record someplace?
The specific. There was a direct appeal taken from that order itself to the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit specifically dealt with it on that basis. I don't think that the Second Circuit, in its majority opinion, went into any analysis as to that order being valid under Title VII, but it was clearly what they considered, and that's evident from the dissenting opinion, which specifically states in no uncertain terms that it's invalid just on that ground.
Now, before lunch, you were talking about two lists from which applicants are accepted for the program. Those lists were not ordered by the court, were they? I thought those were voluntarily structured at the 45% level by the union.
I hardly think that that's voluntary, Your Honor. When you're living under a quota with threats of the nature which are involved in this case, and in order to do your best to come as close to trying to comply with that, you voluntarily, I say in quotes, engage in reverse discrimination, I don't regard that as voluntary.
Well, at least the Second Circuit said that the defendants had voluntarily set up the 45% list.
The majority opinion said that, Your Honor, and that was their basis for invalidating a specific provision in the newly revised an affirmative action plan, creating a mandatory one-to-one, one minority for one majority. As I say, that's hardly voluntary. Now,
how is the term non-white defined in the order?
Non-white is a person of a Negro person or a person with a Spanish surname. Now, where did that definition come from? It came from the original complaint filed by the Department of Justice in 1971, in which they defined that term as such. The definition was carried forward in the pretrial order, which led to the district judge's decisions. It's been carried on ever since. Does that make any sense? I have difficulty with it. For example, this union now has a reasonable number of Orientals. Those Orientals are counted as whites. It had very few Orientals, if any, back in 1964 when this whole business began. But nevertheless, that's the definition.
Why you had not achieved the goals?
He's given one reason. Can you go ahead?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. The primary reason is because during the period involved, there were extraordinary economic reverses in the construction industry in New York, of which this union is one part. I'm sure you'll recall that during just this period, from 1975 to 1980, which is the critical period here, the construction industry in New York was in terrible straits. As a result, the membership of this union went from in excess of 3,000 members to approximately 2,000 members during that period of time. And there weren't any jobs for the journeymen. And there weren't any jobs for anybody. At times, even of the membership, and during the low point of this, 42% of the union members were employed, not unemployed, but employed. The rest of them were all unemployed. There just wasn't any construction going on in New York. Now, at that time, how is it possible to interest anyone, white or black or purple, in becoming a member of this union or in joining this business? That was the primary problem. But I think that this failure was inevitable anyway, without the most extraordinary kind of reverse discrimination, which I think could never be tolerated.
Well, but it was possible with extraordinary reverse discrimination, as you call it. The 45% I take it was accepted by the special master, or whatever you call him, the administrator.
It was accepted by the plaintiffs in 1981 as well.
Yes.
And the union had done it voluntarily before then, even though each class of apprentices had been very small as a result of the
But you say that was it was inevitable anyway, and so you, so
yes, I think
so. The remedy does that translate into an assertion that a satisfactory remedy was impossible?
Well, I think that calling this civil contempt, and treating it the way the district court did, just mixed up civil and criminal contempt remedy.
Well, this is a contempt argument, and I understand that's part of your argument, but that isn't a much of a Title VII argument.
Well, I'm not sure that I understand your question, then, Your Honor. The point with respect to the contempt is this. In a civil contempt situation, the purpose of it is to coerce somebody to obey an order which is yet unobeyed. That's the primary purpose. And in fact, as I read Section 1101, which is the contempt section under the Civil Rights Act, I think that's the only permissible purpose. It's the only basis on which this was sustained by the Second Circuit.
Mr. Gold, excuse me for interrupting you.
Yes, Justice Powell.
I have a question or two that may not be relevant, but as a matter of interest, did the district court's order require any member of the union to be laid off?
No, Your Honor.
In what way, if any, did the order of the district court discriminate against a particular member of the union?
I don't think that it did discriminate against any existing member.
But you use the term reverse discrimination. I'm trying to identify the impact, if any, on individual members of the union.
I think that the impact is on people coming into the union who desire to come into
who are not in the union already.
Yes, sir.
And who are wanting to get in the apprenticeship program.
Yes, sir.
And it seems to me I read in one of the briefs that existing union members are required to pay for the apprentice program. Is that correct? Who pays for it?
They do, Your Honor, as they pay for everything else that's going on here.
They pay for the administrator, too. Right?
They pay for the administrator. The administrator's fees, as of the end of November, have been close to $700,000 so far for his services. He's been involved in this on essentially a daily basis since he was originally appointed.
Has there been any problem about the availability of qualified non-whites?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is...
Does that enter into the achieving 15% instead of 29%?
That certainly is a factor, Your Honor.
Is there material on that in the record?
There is, Your Honor. The material, we didn't print it, but it's reports that indicate that smaller percentages of non-whites than one would hope had passed the entrance tests. I would like to reserve.
You said it would have been impossible to achieve this 29% under any circumstances.
The only way that this could have been achieved is if there was an extraordinary boom in the construction industry in New York, and at the same time, the union essentially said, we're only going to take blacks or close to only blacks, and went out
into the apprentice program.
Into the apprentice program. Now, as a result...
Didn't you run the apprentice program, whether the construction industry was on the boom or in the...
We did, Your Honor, but during the lean years, there were just a small number of apprentices who were in the program. Many who joined dropped out because they weren't able to get jobs. It's a four-year apprentice program, and during that period of time, people have to work. And if there are no jobs, it's very difficult to attract or keep people. I'd like to reserve a few moments, few minutes at the end of my time. Thank you.
Mr. Sherwood.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. In listening to Mr. Gold this morning and in the first part of this afternoon, I was struck by his characterization of the condition of the union that we have here before us today. I would think that neither the District Court nor the Court of Appeals would have recognized the union and its supposed compliance as described by Mr. Gold this morning. References to the term like egregious conduct comes not so much from the amici or the briefs filed by the respondents, but rather is a term used by the lower courts in describing the conduct of this union. For over two decades, the courts have been prodding this reluctant union towards full compliance with local, state, and federal laws requiring equality of opportunity and employment. And our appearance here today is simply the latest stop along that arduous road. This afternoon, I want to focus on the meaning of Section 706G as it relates to the issues that are before the Court. And of course, we stand on all of the arguments that we make in our brief. Initially, I want to state briefly our position regarding Section 706G. I intend to respond to briefly to a few of the points made by Mr. Gold this morning and early this afternoon, and then return to a fuller discussion of Section 706G. To the extent that the Court determines that it should address the reach of the remedial authority of district courts under Title VII, it is our position that Section 706G itself gives courts broad authority to grant relief that realistically will work to fully remedy the discrimination that it has found. In some cases, and I suggest that this is one such case, that includes the power to order affirmative, race-conscious relief which benefits some people who are not the proven victims of the identified discrimination. Imposition of a per se rule that prevents a district court from ordering such remedies in appropriate cases is at odds with the plain language of the statute itself. As is evident in the decisions of the courts of appeals that are charged with responsibility for implementing and overseeing implementation of the statute, such a rule would deprive the courts of the needed tools, the tools they need in order to carry out the statute's central purpose of rooting out identified discrimination and its effects. We believe, however, that the determination of whether or not non-victim-specific race-conscious remedies should be ordered should be left initially to the discretion of the district courts. That is the scheme that Congress envisioned when it enacted and amended Title VII. Of course, that relief should be tailored to cure the effects of the identified discrimination. Considerations that should attend that determination to impose prospective race-conscious remedies have already been suggested by this Court in Weber and by Justice Powell's opinion in Fuller Love. They include the efficacy of alternative remedies, the planned duration of the remedy, the relationship between the percentage of minority workers admitted to membership and the percentage of minority group members in the relevant labor pool, the availability of waiver provisions if the hiring plan cannot be met, and the effect of that plan on third parties. Regarding a number of the points that Mr. Gold made earlier, I'd like to just make a few comments. One, the district court's order here does not impose a quota. The 45% number that Mr. Gold has referred to is one selected by the union. What the district court has ordered in this case is that the union move with dispatch towards overcoming the long history of discrimination that it has practiced.
How about the 29% figure, Mr.
Schultz? The 29% figure, Justice Rehnquist, is a number which the district court said you shall move ahead with, make regular and substantial progress, and those are the words the court used, towards getting to the 29%. It is a means by which the court measured how long it would closely supervise this union's progress towards integration.
There was no time requirement from the district court?
There is a time requirement, which has been, incidentally, reset a few times now. The court recognized early on that that conditions beyond the control of the union, such as conditions in the union, might require adjustment. And the court has done so, as I said, on two occasions. What the court has required, and has said so in several places in the record, is that it wants the union to move ahead and move ahead with dispatch.
Well, supposing the district court had said, I think you should aim for 29%, and I think you should attain, and I'm going to order you to attain it 6 years hence. Would you say that is not a quota?
And if you don't, I'll fine you.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to debate the whether we're talking about a quota or a goal, because it seems to me that the terms, although many people use them, doesn't focus in precisely on the concept.
Would you say that's permissible?
But let's call it a quota.
Yeah. Is that permissible for a district court to do under your view of 706?
I believe so, yes. The district court could do what it has ordered in this case.
How did the district judge come to 29.23?
It came to 29.23 on the basis of the evidence it had before it, that was the proportion of, the proper proportion of non-white.
I assumed it was drawn from some such, but the fraction seems to be a little curious.
That was the result of the particular evidence before the district court in 1982.
Here, this is a fluctuating. The market is fluctuating. The number of people employed at a given time is fluctuating.
No, it's not.
Is that not so?
The 60, well, certainly the number of people in the market may fluctuate over time, but that 29.23% was fixed in 1982 as a result of, yes, a change in the relevant labor pool, and also, and most importantly, because the jurisdiction of the union had changed as a result of a merger of other unions into this union. There was a proceeding before the district court in which the union proposed that the proper end goal should be around 21%. The plaintiffs in the case asked for percentages ranging between 33 and 41%. The district court had in the record before it testimony to the effect that the proportion of non-whites in the labor market, in the defined labor market, who are within the appropriate age ranges was 29.23%, and that's where the number came from. So the district judge picked a number which was in between that which the union was proposing and that which the plaintiffs were proposing. As I said, the...
But anyway, the figure was supposed to match the percentage of available applicants in the labor market.
In the labor market, that's correct.
Of whatever was defined as minority.
That's correct, yeah. And that was based on the evidence that was before presented to the district judge. Mr. Gold suggested that the fund sets up 100% quota with respect to those items that are addressed in that particular order. I should point out that the district court made quite clear that the union was free, if it chose, to extend those kinds of benefits to whites as well. But the court was not going to itself impose, require that the union extend those benefits to white individuals. I should point out, too, that the selection board that selects people for the apprenticeship program are all union members. One is selected by the administrator, one is selected by the plaintiffs, and one is designated by the union. But they're all members of Local 28. Importantly, I think it's important to recognize precisely what
the union was about. Did the plaintiffs agree to the 45% at one point in this proceeding or not?
The plaintiffs did acquiesce in that, yes, Justice White.
And have they ever asked for a higher percentage?
At one point, the plaintiffs sought to obtain an order from the district judge for a one-to-one ratio for placing people into the apprenticeship program.
What did the judge say? No?
The district court did order that, but the Court of Appeals stripped that portion of the order for the reason that since the union was voluntarily indenturing non-whites at 45%, there was no need for
Would one-to-one have attained the 29% goal, do you know?
By 1986, I don't think so, Justice White.
And any more than 45%?
I don't think the difference is significant, but I think it's important to remember precisely what led to this union being held in contempt. They were not held in contempt for not meeting the 29% goal. Mm-hmm. They were held in contempt for not trying particularly hard.
But they're still an order.
Pardon?
They're still under an order to attain that, shoot for that goal.
Yes, that is correct. But that's precisely it. They are under an order to shoot for that goal. It requires that they meet the 29% and currently says they ought to meet the 29% by the middle of 1986. At one point in the past, it said they were to meet it by the middle of 1981, and it was then changed to 1982 because of conditions in the industry. And if there is evidence in the record...
If the union had complied with all of the acts, all of the orders that they've been held in contempt for disobeying, would there have been any greater chance of achieving the goal or quota or whatever you call it?
I cannot say that they would have achieved it. I can say with certainty that they would have been much further along the road. Mm-hmm. And it is for foot dragging that they were held in contempt,
right.
Not for not reaching the goal. That's important, too, to see what the district court did here. The district court ordered the union to not artificially close down the size of the apprenticeship program. And it is in order to provide greater opportunities for minorities to enter into the trade, and also to limit the impact of the court's order on third parties who are
seeking to enter the... Is the 29% union membership or part of the apprenticeship program? It's the union membership.
29% membership, which includes both journeymen and apprentices. The number is that they're lumped together.
Uh-huh.
For purposes of making that.
Could I ask you, Judge Winter said this, and I'm sure you're aware of it, in dissent. However, in light of the facts that large numbers of journeymen did not work during the period in question, or only worked meager hours, reactive finger-pointing at Local 28 is faintly camouflaged, holding that journeymen should have been replaced by minority apprentices on a strictly racial basis. Is there any, do you have any response?
There is nothing in the court's order that required the union to displace journeymen as such. The standard within the industry was generally, and this isn't a strict requirement now, that there be a ratio of apprentices to journeymen on roughly a 1-to-4 basis.
1-to-4, yeah.
What occurred during the time period that we're concerned about was that the ratio of apprentices to journeymen went way up. I mean, in some shops you were talking about 1 in 22.
Because of there wasn't any work.
Well, and because the union kept the size of the apprenticeship program very low as compared to journeymen. And if you look at the hours worked by journeymen during that period of time, the curve goes way up. Again, the journeymen increased their hours during that time period, and the court, given that kind of evidence, concluded that what the union was about was shifting work from apprentices to journeymen to the disadvantage and in violation of the court's order requiring that it make regular and substantial effort towards integrating its membership. Mr. Goll indicated that there's evidence in the record of an inadequate number of minorities applying for the apprenticeship program. He refers to the fact that in 1981, the union indicated that minorities were not doing well on the test. The reason why early on the court required that the union validate its selection procedures, the union elected not to attempt to do that. And so the bit of evidence that Mr. Goll is referring to is that the minorities were not passing this unvalidated selection procedure that the union had been using. And that is why it switched from using this paper and pencil test to the selection board. And so I would say that there's no question in this case as to the unavailability of qualified non-whites to seeking admission into the union. I might point out that in the last couple of years, the rate of application among minorities entering in this union, seeking membership in the union, has been running between 40% and 50% and 75%, depending on which particular class you look at. But returning to Section 706G itself, the provision is worded broadly as one could imagine. It authorizes courts, upon a finding of unlawful discrimination, to order such affirmative action as may be appropriate, which may include, but is not limited to, reinstatement and so on, and any other equitable relief as the court deems appropriate. This sentence is the source of the court's power to award race-conscious relief, which in appropriate cases may benefit persons who are not proven victims of discrimination. There are, however, some policy choices that Congress built into the statute, which operate to guide the discretion in awarding affirmative relief. One of those choices, incorporated into the last sentence of Section 706G, says in essence that a court should not require an employer to hire a particular individual who it chooses not to hire for reasons other than unlawful discrimination. The remedy which a particular individual may demand for himself is restricted to make whole relief. He doesn't acquire the right to employment simply because the employer was found guilty of discriminating against the group of which he is a member. Another policy choice is that the statute is prospective in its application. It doesn't require the removal of employees who were hired as a result of the prior discrimination.
Where do you find that?
We find that only in the legislative history of in the legislative history of the statute.
And you think that restricts? You think that restricts 706G, so that you couldn't require the discharge of non-minorities to hire minorities to achieve a certain goal?
That's what Congress in enacting the statute.
You think Congress intended not to permit that?
That's what I understood Congress to.
Based on the legislative
to
history.
It's based on the legislative history. I don't see anything in the statute itself.
Whose statement do you?
That says that.
Whose statements do you rely on? Are they stated in your brief?
I believe we may have mentioned it in our brief. What comes to mind is Senator Clark in Case's memorandum, which refers to
that's fairly authoritative.
It is one of the authorities that is important. All I'm saying with respect to that, however, is that it says that we're giving a 1-year delay before the statute comes into effect, and it makes reference to the fact that the statute is prospective. But there is nothing in the language of the statute itself that says one could not discharge individuals who were hired because of discrimination.
Mr. Sherwood, do you think your view of 706 has been true ever since 1964, or do you think it was enacted in 1972?
No, I believe it's been true since 1964.
So you don't rely on anything that happened in 1972 as having broadened the relief of the kind you're talking about?
Certainly the 1972 amendment has broadened Section 706G. There's no question about that. By its terms. But it was not necessary for the Congress in 1972 to broaden the statute as it did in order for courts to award the kind of relief that we're talking about here.
So then you discount a good deal of what your opponents cite as legislative history to the 1964 Act, the statements by Congressman Seller and people that we're not authorizing quotas and we're not having any of that sort of thing.
Congress in those statements were referring to and giving assurances to individuals who believe that this statute, if enacted, would require employers across the nation to achieve or maintain a racial balance. That's what those Congress.
Some of them referred to courts ordering this sort of thing as a kind of relief.
Indeed, courts can't enter an order that would maintain a racial balance, and the reason for that is that once the court has remedied discrimination, and it may include the use of, in getting to full compliance, that may include the use of goals and other race-conscious means, having done that and having fully remedied discrimination, a court order could not then go on and require that the employer maintain any particular racial balance.
Because that would violate the section itself, or because of the, it's just a, would be an exorbitant remedy, or both?
Because it would no longer be remedial at that point. But there's no specific words in Section 706G that says a court may not maintain a
So you think balance. the limits of 706G, you think we must refer to the legislative history for guidance?
I think you don't have to look to the legislative history for the purposes of this case. Mm-hmm. We can decide this case on the basis of the plain meaning of the statute itself. There's no need to look to the legislative history for any of the issues that are before us here. With respect, in some other factual context, perhaps there may be some need to look at the legislative history. But given this particular case and its facts, I think the plain meaning of the statute itself is all that's required. And indeed, if one looks at the decisions of the courts of appeals and the consistent actions of the federal agencies that are responsible for enforcing Title VII, following the enactment of the 1964 Act, you would see that those agencies and those courts recognized that the courts had the power that I suggested it has. And indeed, in 1972, when Congress was amending the law, it recognized that the courts already had those powers, and that appears quite clearly in comments, say, from Senator Javits.
Had those powers, specifically what powers?
The power to
the
order.
Contempt power, but to
the power to order whatever relief would realistically work in order to remedy completely the identified discrimination that had been found.
Well, except discharging non-minorities, or what?
With respect to discharging non-minorities,
where do you get that limit on 706G?
It comes out of the only place that I've seen it is in the legislative history of the 64 Act, but not in Section 706G itself. What Congress did in 1964 is equip the is recognize the broad equitable powers of district courts to order whatever relief would work, and the district courts following 1964 have found that in order to fully remedy discrimination, it was necessary to have, in appropriate cases, the kinds of remedies that may extend to individuals who are not already the proven victims of discrimination. Certainly, the district court's whether a district court orders race-conscious remedies in a given case depends on the particular facts. And questions and considerations that would go into that determination should include whether or not other means that are available to the district court would be effective to carry out that purpose. Questions regarding whether or not how long the duration of the program. Certainly, once discrimination is remedied completely, there's no need to continue to use those specific race-conscious means. And so, in that sense, the program would necessarily be temporary. Its the end goal should be properly fixed. And a way of determining that is seeing what condition this particular union would have been in absent discrimination. One would have expected, in this case, that the non-white membership of this union would be somewhere around 29% had it not been guilty of discrimination.
Did the union draw its membership only from New York City?
Principally.
But not only?
Some of its members did live outside New York City. That question was raised in the very first appeal in this case as to the appropriate scope of the appropriate dimension or scope of the labor market. I should point out that no issues have been raised with respect to that particular question, the scope of the labor market, on this appeal. It's a matter that was raised and resolved a decade ago, and no petition for writ of certiorari was sought at that time. Of course, the degree of flexibility that should go into the fashioning of any particular plan is a matter that ought to be considered as well. I think the district court did precisely that in this case. And finally, the incidental effects that the program may have on others should be considered. What the district court did in this case was to require that the union maintain an apprenticeship program of adequate size, realistically fixed in terms of the availability of work within the industry, so that there would be a stream of minorities and non-minorities entering into full membership in the union. It is that problem, the problem of constricting the size of the apprenticeship program itself, that has been a repeated problem in this case.
Mr. Sherwood, on page 14 of the petitioner's brief in their summary of argument, they say that they're complaining about the geographical area.
Oh, they're saying that now. All I'm saying, Justice Rehnquist, is that they did not complain about that in the Court of Appeals.
Well, they've complained about it once in the Court of Appeals, and this is the same case that originally raised it. It's now here on certiorari. We're certainly not bound by what the Court of Appeals said.
Well, they raised it. Are you referring to when they raised it 10 years ago?
Yes.
Certainly they raised it.
There's no law of the case that binds this Court.
We're not suggesting that law of the case applies here. What we say applies here with respect to that issue is res judicata.
There's never been a final judgment in this case, so it can't possibly be res judicata.
Well, there certainly has been a final judgment.
Is this not the same case that was litigated 10 years ago?
Yes.
Then it's not res judicata.
As I understand the principle of res judicata, once a case has been tried and tried to judgment, and there's been the opportunity to appeal, and the 90 days that one gets in order to seek certiorari in this case.
Well, are you saying
passes,
these people never took this issue to the Court of Appeals?
They took it to the Court of Appeals in 1976.
Yeah, but this Court can revise any part of this case that came along if it was once taken to the Court of Appeals.
My understanding of res judicata is that once the time to appeal is end, following a trial on the merits, that after the time to appeal has expired, that's it. Even if the court continues to maintain jurisdiction over the case.
Do you understand it differs from that?
Fair enough. I see that my time is up.
Mr. Goles, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. One of the problems in this case is the fact that I believe the Second Circuit has misunderstood the difference between quotas and goals from the beginning of this case and even before. The difference is set forth on page 9 and 10 of our reply brief, and it comes from an authoritarian memorandum which was issued in 1973 by the EEOC, the Department of Justice, the Civil Service Commission, and the Office of Federal Contract Compliance. Those are the agencies which have federal responsibility for enforcing the law in this area. And there are really three elements to the difference. It's a quota if it's a fixed number or percentage which must be achieved, if that percentage must be achieved regardless of number of applicants or economic circumstances, and if there's sanctions for its failure to reach that percentage. If, on the other hand, it's a numerical objective and it's precatory, it's subject to change with experience and it's not subject to sanctions, then it's a goal. Now, the Second Circuit adopted a different test in the Rios case in 1973. Their test doesn't look at any of those criteria. Instead, it says it looks at only one criteria, that is, must the percentage of membership be maintained after it's attained? In other words, according to the Second Circuit, if there's an order, as there was in this case, directing a party to achieve a numerical membership of X percent by a specific date, that is a goal, says the Second Circuit. If, on the other hand, the order goes further and states that that percentage must be thereafter maintained at that level, then the Second Circuit says that's a quota. I suggest to you that that just is plain wrong. That comes from the Rios case in 1973, and that's the rule that the Second Circuit was enforcing when it made that difference in this case. Now, the various circuits that have looked at this issue all say, I believe every one of them says that quotas are no good and goals on certain circumstances are permissible.
Well, as I understand it, you'd be making your argument here whether this, even if you agreed that it was a goal.
I would, Your Honor.
You would be making the same 706G argument.
I would, Your Honor, absolutely. But I don't think that I have to go that far in this case.
Well, you may.
Perhaps I may. And I don't think that goals are very good either. And I don't think that they're permitted under 706G, and they've got some problems. They've got two very specific problems. One is they tend to degenerate into quotas if they're enforced that way. And second is the basic assumption for them seems to me to be fallacious. The assumption is that if you have a workforce with 29% of a certain background person, that in the absence of discrimination, that same percentage of those people is going to gravitate to each occupation. And that just is contrary to human experience. That's not the way that people line themselves up. Now, one other point that I would like to make. Mr. Sherwood.
One point worries me is this whole question of the goals was established in the case that you didn't bring up here.
That we didn't bring it? The issue was the issue of goals and quotas.
Well, yeah.
The Second Circuit, which...
Well, you didn't apply for cert, did you?
We didn't apply for cert.
Why?
I wasn't representing this party at that time, Your Honor, but I think the reason that people don't ask for cert is because they want to live without litigation, if it's possible, rather than go on endlessly, as
lawyers
has proved to be
expensive.
Necessary. Yes? Thank you. I see my time is up.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear...